Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Centre. I'm Vishnu Shom. On the programme tonight, the Uttar Pradesh government gives ₹1 lakh to each district for special events, including the Akhand Ramayan recitation on Navratri. Events are meant to be held in every block and all preparations must be complete by the 21st of March. It's being monitored by the state government, the top leadership. While the separation of the state and religion, as espoused by our constitution, has been at the core of the secular ideal, these standards have been questioned in Uttar Pradesh. Year after year, for example, Kanwar Yatris have been garlanded by everyone from political leaders to police officers. They've been showered petals from helicopters. Now, this celebration of Navratri by the state government, which will be paying for these celebrations as well. Now, this is not a debate on the significance of Hindu religious festivals at all. It's more about whether this is being done to push the idea of a Hindu Rashtra ahead of elections, something which is at odds with the basic identity of what India has been. So on our first debate, after Kanwarya's, Yogi goes big on Navratri. Is this a blurring of lines between religion and state? Next on the show at 1:30, India was the world's 8th most polluted country in 2022, dropping from 5th place the previous year. While the PM2.5 level has dipped, that is still 10 times the World Health Organization's safe limit. The ranking was decided by the Swiss firm IQ Air. We'll be talking to their leadership and the World Air Quality Report and also experts from across the country. It's PM2.5 that we are looking at. Remember, that is what gets to your lungs. That's what causes maximum damage. Significantly, the report indicates that 39 of the 50 most polluted cities in the world are in India. In broad terms, what can this potentially mean for millions of residents of major Indian cities? But we're going to quickly move on now to our big debate. The Uttar Pradesh government has put in a lot of money and a lot of effort at ensuring that Navratri celebrations take place across the state. Again, it's not about the celebrations themselves, but it is the decision of the government to be pushing the celebration and spending money on it, which is what we are looking at it. Because according to our constitution, there is a separation of the state and religion. On our panel this evening, Professor Nikita Sood, she joins us from Oxford University, Ghanshyam Tiwari of the Samajwadi Party, Shantanu Gupta, the author of The Monk Who Became Chief Minister, and the BJP leader Alok Watts with us as well. Shantanu Gupta, let me come to you first. Should any state, in fact, be spending money on religious festivals specific to any one religion, as has been done in Uttar Pradesh?
See, Indian states and central government has a history, Som, of spending on religious festivals, be it iftar parties multiple times, or Kumbh has been celebrated by the government from Jawaharlal Nehru's time, right? And at least for Hindu festival, it's very appropriate because large number of Hindu temples and their donations are managed by the government. So it's only appropriate for them to spend money. And as far as the point of segregation of state and religion is concerned, a panelist is joining from Oxford. In Oxford, multiple seats are reserved for bishops in one of the houses. In Germany, the government gives money to the churches directly. In America, president goes to a particular church before taking the oath, right? So, and last time when UP government spent money for the Kumbh, 4,000 crore rupees, that generated economy of 1 lakh crore rupees. India has almost 200 cities which runs on religious economy. So religion is not only the sentiment of people, it's also a lot of economy. So I think it's makes sense.
Okay, Nikita Sood, do you believe this makes economic sense and that it shouldn't just be looked at through the prism of a state government pushing a Hindutva agenda?
Thanks for this opportunity to comment. I'm delighted that the discussion has gone to economics. In economics, we talk about the guns and butter argument. We have finite resources and we have to decide what to do with them. The previous speaker spoke about religion generating economic goods. UP's economy is telling us a very different story. India is categorized as a low middle income country in global rankings. In terms of income, UP's GDP per capita is half of the rest of India, at something like $1,265 a year. It's at the same level as Afghanistan. So if UP's government thinks that it wants to deploy the funding that it does have and the public time that it does have in terms of public servants being asked to do religious activities, that's a very clear sort of statement of priorities of the government. The economic figures are very different. And perhaps the government should be looking at basic needs of the population rather than, you know, religious sort of festivals, which, you know, other temples, mosques, etc. should be looking at rather than governments. Their priorities ought to be different.
Ghanshyam Tiwari, you know, some would suggest that what we are actually seeing now, despite the arguments on this being making sound business sense and making sound sense from a tourist perspective as well, is what the BJP has been doing for a long time, a mixture of, let us say, three elements, Hindutva, nationalism and pilgrimage in Uttar Pradesh. And it's been doing this, and there are several examples of this. In doing this, is there not a real danger of religious polarization being strengthened?
Good evening, Vishnu, to you, my fellow co-panelists and the viewers. The Uttar Pradesh elections in 2022 held on the backdrop of a hate speech, powerful hate speech by the chief minister himself on 80-20 politics. The entire BJP has amplified the 80-20 message from policies to politics to vigilantes to the government action, from bulldozers to the street action, lynching, etc. So we must not be surprised that Uttar Pradesh government, led by Adityanath ji, has really, in some way, armed in public narrative anybody who looks at religion and says this is good for the country, good for the people. But in reality, it is the same state government that did not have an adequate compensation to offer to over 1,000 teachers who died in COVID duty because they were hell-bent on doing the panchayat elections. This is the same state government that did not provide adequate relief to millions of workers who walked back from different parts of the country to so-called developed $1 trillion UP economy during COVID times in a four-hour lockdown that was imposed. This is the same state government that has shied away from doing adequate justice to the Hathras victim, including the family of the victim, with respect to compensation. So on one hand, the state remains in abject defiance of the development needs of the state itself, be it the employment, be it the quality of healthcare infrastructure, be it the harmony in the state. On the other end, they are going above board to communicate that this is the party, this is the government that is living the spirit of Hindu religion. But if one looks at the track record of Adityanath ji himself, this is not the spirit of Hindu religion. It is the spirit of a Hindutva politics that is meant to build divide by state promoting one religion and punishing another.
Alok Watts, reply to that. You are polarizing. You're using Hindutva to polarize, number one. And number two, these are the politics of one leader. It's not genuine Hindutva. How would you reply to those points? And thirdly, perhaps a key point, that is there nothing better to be done in terms of the funding available to the state government?
Let me tell you one thing, Som. That the state government, the measures that it has taken is because of the sentiments of the people of Uttar Pradesh. Nobody is against it. And as regards development, my fellow panelist was saying there is no development. 1 trillion. 20 kilometers road being built every day. 44 medical colleges being built. 21 airports are coming. Network of metro. Lakhs and lakhs of toilets. Lakhs and lakhs of houses. All this is not development. What is it? But yes, when it comes to the majority and the sentiments of the majority, we must respect them also. We are not spreading hatred. We are just saying to celebrate it. What is the harm to celebrate it?
Okay.
I don't find anything harm in it.
Professor Sood, that's one way of looking at it. that this is the majority religion in Uttar Pradesh. This is a government which says that they are reflecting the views of people. Nobody has a problem with these celebrations. Why then should anybody have a problem?
That takes us back to whether India is a secular country. In the constitution, we definitely are. The word secularism was only introduced in 1976. But the spirit of secularism goes back to the Constituent Assembly debates, 1946 to 49, and into the spirit of the Constitution, where, of course, there is no sort of direct separation of state and religion like you have in France. But the understanding that the state has to be even-handed from all religions and also protect minorities. We are going very far from that in contemporary India. And to the previous speaker, I'd just like to say that I'm not sure what sort of majority sentiments we are talking about. Is this some sort of democratic, you know, survey that has been done? But I can tell you one thing. You talk to any person in Uttar Pradesh or India or anywhere in the world, they want jobs and they want to put food on their table and they want shelter, right? Those are basic things that every human being wants. India's employment figures right now are pathetic. India has an employment rate of 49%. So the sort of 16 to 64 age group that is looking for jobs, less than half of those people are employed. UP is much, much worse than the Indian average. During the pandemic, it was 31%. Today, it is 22% employment figures for the age group 16 to 64. So if you ask these people, do you want the government to be focusing on celebrating festivals, or do you want the government to be giving you jobs, to be investing in your education, to be investing in your healthcare? I have no doubt that what every person is going to say is, you know, give me education, okay, give me jobs, make sure I have food to eat and my family to shelter and feed. Yeah. Once we are a very developed country and those roads have people on them, the airports, very bad for climate, but railways or infrastructure that, you know, governments may be building, once people are actually able to use them, then we may have a debate about what does secularism
Nikita,
mean.
Nikita, so while I understand the first part of what you're saying, I can vouch for the fact that the highways work, the airports increasingly work. The first phase of the new airport outside Delhi and Jewar, they've just come out with details today. They are on schedule. This affects millions across our country and millions in that state. So I think in as much as you talk about priorities, I think some of the economic highlights you have pointed out actually are functioning, and we see it on the ground. But be that as it may, Shantanu, you know, the point which has been made is on identity. And when we merge a national identity, which in the case of the BJP is often a Hindu national identity, with any specific religious identity, doesn't it lead to othering of other communities? Is that what we are seeking? So the basic question is this. It's great that you have Navratri celebrations. If a state government is doing this, then are you not in the process breaking our tradition of secularism in favoring one religion over another? That's what this debate is all about. Shantanu, you're on mute.
Soam, I'll repeat some of the points I said earlier, and none of the panelists, for some reason, they were alluded to it. So when UK government give a reservation to multiple bishops in the court, does the country doesn't remain secular? When the London Municipal Corporation set a very decent amount for the Christmas celebration every year, near, I lived in three European countries, and everywhere I found out there's a very decent allocation. And a very interesting point, Nikita Suji said that secularism is only a debate, which I heard correctly, that once you improve your per capita income, then only talk about secularism. Otherwise, you are not even worthy of talking about such debates. And Ghanshyam alluded that as if like Navratra or Kavan Yatra will create religious divide. Navratra never created a religious divide. In fact, I'll allude to my point earlier. In the 4,000 crore the UP government spent in Kumbh last year, it generated an economy of 1 lakh crore. Almost 10,000 Safai Karmis and multiple such people were employed. So these people, you know, Kavar Yatra, which a lot of my friend from the left hate, a lot of the Kavars are made by Muslim people from Jorapur. And it's a big economy. They wait for those 15 days for Kavar Yatra when the whole economy from Delhi to Neelkanth flourishes. So I again allude to the point that 200, 250 cities in India, they run on religious economy. Religious tourism is the second largest tourism in India. So a lot of people have to get their facts right.
Ghanshyam, would you like to reply to that? That, you know,
well, I think one must look at the RBI state of the state survey to debunk the claims that is made not just by Shantanu, but the person who he writes the biography for, Mr. Adityanath himself, in saying that UP has doubled its per capita income. The RBI state of the state survey publishes the per capita income and various parameters of every state every year. In no year has UP increased its per capita income by 10%. And if you look at the overall per capita income, it was the per capita and NSDP current prices in 2017-18 was 57,944. In 21-22, it is merely 68,810. So I think that there is no match to false claims of BJP. If you want to find out more, just step out in Delhi and you will see that the BJP, the UP government is already claiming they have brought 32 lakh crore of investment or XYZ lakh crore of investment that is going to...
Ghanshyam, we'll fix that line and we'll come back to you in a moment. 90. But let me just go across to Alok Vats. Mr. Vats, I think the point that I've been trying to get at, and I think it's quite interesting that this entire debate has moved into this economic argument. I'm just trying to look at the religious and religion and politics. If you look at what Yogi Adityanath said on the 27th of January this year, he said that Sanatan Dharma is India's national dharma, right? The country is secure when we connect to a national religion. And that national temple is being made in the form of the Ram temple. It's sort of subsuming all other faiths into one monolithic Hinduism. Again, my question remains, are you therefore not othering other communities? And if you are doing that, doesn't that violate what our constitution says?
So, what we are doing is for the Hindus. But equally, we have done for the Muslims also. The Teen Talaq was for the Muslims. And there have been instances when we have given the houses, we have given the toilets, we have not bifurcated between Hindu and Muslims.
You can't. Because that would be illegal.
Come again?
You can't on a government scheme say that we are being discriminatory to one faith over the other. They're all citizens. So you can't do that. That's illegal. But I'm talking about priorities of the government by pushing or promoting a particular religious festival over the other.
What is the harm? It is the majority people whose sentiments are there. So what is the harm in celebrating that? When people are abusing it, when they are tearing it. So we have to, rever it. Which Hindu will tear the, you know, Ramayana? Which Hindu will point fingers at Ramcharitmanas? So if that is being gathered and, you know, things are going in their favor,
Professor Sood, in fact, that hits the nail on the head. This is the identity that lies at the heart of what the BJP champions. And in as much as people can talk about secularism and how that identity is what we are constitutionally bound to follow, this is the core belief of Mr. Vats, which is what people in the ruling dispensation, and they represent millions across this country, believe in. So therefore, when we talk about secularism, I mean, are we not pushing a passe idea, certainly in the context of Uttar Pradesh of 2023?
So the BJP is being true to its roots. The RSS is about one country, one nation, one people, one religion. So they are pushing the interests of that religion. I think as citizens more widely, we have to ask, what does this imply for the country and its development, as we've been talking about? But in the constitution, secularism is not very clearly defined. In the constituent assembly debates, there were some people talking about the majority religion being an elder brother to the minority religions. whereas there were others who said there should be no religion in the state, it should be even-handed, and science is much more important than religion.
Yes.
We have never quite worked through that ambiguity, but the result of the very clear one-sidedness of the current government is both in the economy and in society. In society, they are, you know, very clearly aligned with one religion. So Kavadiyas are welcomed, Namazis are, you know, kicked off the road by government or fringe sort of elements that the government sort of sponsors or, you know, certainly doesn't put in jail. The same is happening in the economy. We recently overtook the UK and became the fifth largest economy in the world. We're a $3 trillion economy and we want to be $5 trillion. What I was saying at the start was this is not trickling down to people. That is why we are, UP is at the same level as Afghanistan in per capita income. That is why Afghanistan and Pakistan are ahead of UP and many other states in India in terms of who they are able to provide employment to. So we are skewed in terms of who our economic benefits are going to, and that's via the state. And the state is similarly skewed in who it aligns with in religious terms. This is a privatization of the state in every form. It suits some people. Others need to be asking, is this the priority of the government? And where do, you know, the rest of us stand in all of this, in economic terms and in societal terms?
Shantanu, I'll let you answer that question, but I have one point. If you look at our Constituent Assembly, there were 299 members, 255 members, that's what, 85%, were Hindus. But despite being a massive majority, the effort of members of the Constituent Assembly was to protect the interests of the minority. From there, we've come to Uttar Pradesh now, where policemen shower petals on Kavadiyas, where chief ministers wash the feet of Yatris. There's nothing wrong with the practice, but it's part of pushing a particular faith or religion or a particular belief at the expense, perhaps, of others. You know, privatization of the state to do this, to use the words of Professor Sood. Is that right? Is that what we want to be? Again, Shantanu, you're on mute. Yeah.
I never realized that showering petals on Kavadiyas with air feels so much. I'll iterate the same point again. Whom is being celebrated by the government money from Jawaharlal Nehru's time? Indira Gandhi attended the same kum, Rajiv Gandhi attended the same kum. And again, when Oxford gives a break on Easter, when Oxford gives a break on Christmas, does it become non-secular? Oxford doesn't give a 10-day break on Diwali. Doesn't give it. So a lot of things will be run by the majority because there are not so many majority students there. I think this debate's become very binary. And the Oxford student didn't answer me that, do you find the country you are living in is not secular by sending multiple bishops to the parliament? Do you think Oxford is not secular by giving an Easter break? Do you think Oxford is not secular by giving a Christmas break? That's why making these debates binary becomes very simple. But when you see the nuances of a population, you have to react to the population.
That's a valid point. Professor Sood, this debate has become binary. The fact that the BJP does the Kanwar Yatra, celebrates it, or Navratris now, means that it is anti-Muslim. Whereas the point that I think Shantanu is making through examples is that that's not the case at all. Is that the trap that we've fallen into as we discuss this, Professor Sood?
I'm not sure why the esteemed speaker is obsessing about Oxford or the UK. I think we should very much focus on India and debate our priorities. I think through its actions,
that's a very, very convenient escape.
Priorities very clear. Does the citizenship of India want those priorities while less than half of employment seekers are employed? Is a question that the people of India should answer. I frankly couldn't care less who is entering parliament, which bishops, which priests, etc. I'm much more interested in questions of development.
Shantanu, just repeat that. Repeat that. I'm sure Professor Sood will answer.
You reserve 20 seats for Hindu priests in parliament and then see the headings from New York Times and Washington Post. So I think you can't shoo away. That's a very convenient escape, Professor Sood.
I think we should get over the colonial hangover that is sort of on exhibit here and focus on our country.
So I'm able to make Professor agree that UK is a non-secular country by sending bishops. So I think, thank you for that.
You have set your own agenda, but carry on. That's fine. I think the conversation here is not about...
You don't even reply. So are you comfortable with UK sending 23 bishops to their house? Are you comfortable with the fact? Just a question.
Are you comfortable with 49%
Counter question is not answer. That's a convenient escape, Professor Su.
No, I'm not sure it is. That's a bit unfair, Shantanu. You made a point. Let her make this point as well. Please go ahead, Professor Sood. And Shantanu, you're welcome to come in after that. Finish your point, Professor Sood.
Since the 49%, person has taken to questioning me, I think I should put the ball in his court and ask if he is comfortable with UP having employment figures of 22% as of today.
Shantanu, last reply to you.
See, this questioning can go on and we all pick data conveniently from 1 month, 1 quarter, and my books, which are available in your university itself, in Oxford University Library, can counter-prove you. You should just go to your library. And again, I did not get the answer by giving holiday on Easter and Christmas. That Oxford become non-secular?
No, but I think the answer, Shantanu, is that it's not. It's hardly about Oxford. She just happens to work over there.
I can give you multiple examples.
She could have been working anywhere.
Now,
you can't.
No,
but Shantanu, respectfully, Shantanu, 1 second. I think it's a bit unfair that you would target Professor Sood on the basis of where she works. Please target her on what she argues.
No, I can give a
but what difference does it matter where she works?
I can give a similar example.
I mean, where she works hardly reflects, you know, this argument or this debate. So, I mean, I don't know, Shantanu, if you're being fair there. Harvard, Cambridge, she could have been in Delhi University. She could have been in a university in Lucknow as well. So that's hardly the point, no?
No, I'm just asking a simple fact.
All right, you haven't got that answer. I concede that, and that's partly my fault because I've run out of time on this. But I'd like to thank you very much for being with us. And I think it has been an interesting conversation on something that's happening in Uttar Pradesh. We're going to take a short break and we're going to come back and look at something completely different. The latest air quality reports from a global standpoint are out. 39 of the 50 most polluted cities are in India. That's a matter of huge concern. What are the numbers? What do they say? That's up next. Stay tuned. All right, well, India was the world's eighth most polluted country in 2022, dropping from fifth place the previous year. While the PM2.5 level has dipped, it's still over 10 times the World Health Organization's safe limit. Now, the ranking was decided by the Swiss firm IQ Air in its World Air Quality Report released today. It's based on the level of PM2.5. That's a pollutant closely tracked by scientists and health experts. Significantly, the report indicates that 39 of the 50 most polluted cities in the world are in India. In broad terms, what can this potentially mean for millions of residents of major Indian cities? This is important data to look at, and this is a theme we've been tracking now very closely over at least the last decade. But the numbers still are unfortunately appalling. Well, joining us now, Glory Dolphin Hamis, the CEO of IQ Air North America. Thanks very much, Glory, for being with us. And for producing this very comprehensive report. We're joined by Gopal Shankar Narayanan, an advocate and activist in the Supreme Court of India, and Polash Mukherjee, the lead of air quality at the NRDC. Thank you all for being with us. Glory, let me come to you first. Now, the data from 131 countries is taken from over 30,000 ground-based monitors, either government or non-government operated. That's really interesting. It just indicates the size or scale of this operation. But the report indicates that 39 of the 50 most polluted cities in the world are in India. In broad terms, what can this potentially mean for millions of residents of major Indian cities?
What that means is that there are literally millions of preventable deaths. PM2.5 is the pollutant that kills the most amount of people on this planet. This is why our report really focuses on PM2.5. And unfortunately, these numbers result in literally millions of preventable deaths within India.
Mr. Shankar Narayanan, Glory makes an important point that these are millions of preventable deaths. Now, the fact of the matter is you don't die of air pollution because on a post-mortem report, it rarely states that is the cause, which is perhaps the reason why nobody really knows accurately how many people die of air pollution. The other fact is that people end up dying many years later, perhaps. You don't die instantly of air pollution in most cases. Is that perhaps a reason why there seems to be no value attached to actual deaths caused by air pollution in our country or elsewhere?
I think that's definitely one of the problems, Vishnu. We do have enough evidence now, both medical and otherwise. Your channel, in fact, has hosted several of the leading doctors and physiologists from the Delhi NCR on multiple occasions, including the head of the All India Institute of Medical Sciences, all talking about how Delhi has become a completely polluted airshed, that how infants in Delhi have lungs which look like that of adult smokers, and how particularly in Delhi at the north, which is where the big air pollution story started or restarted after a gap of about a couple of decades in the early 2012-2013 time. That is definitely one of the problems. We do know that there are many bronchial issues, lung cancer, and many other aspects that arise from it, and you don't have that on postmortem reports. You rarely have that being attributed even by medical practitioners as the key cause. But what we, I think, have realized over at least the last 6 or 7 years, with the amount of media glare and publicity, with the kind of proceedings going on in the Supreme Court, the NGT, and the Delhi High Court, is that indoor air pollution is a significant cause of disease in India. And when we say indoor air pollution, we shouldn't be looking at middle class and other classes of society, but towards homes where they're using chulas and very indigenous styles of fuels, right, which has been a major cause. And a lot of it is attributed, at least from what we've seen from the basic source apportionment studies that we've had in the north, to not having fuels which are clean enough with vehicles,
right,
with power plants which continue to be dependent on coal. And also, I think, a very casual attitude towards waste management. My big issue is that we have been dealing with it territorially. So in Delhi, for example, we earlier had EPCA, and now we have the CAQM, which is a body that has been set up by an Act of Parliament to figure out how they're going to address air pollution in the NCR.
Yes.
So even though you have Bombay, which has overtaken Delhi over the winter as the most polluted city in India, and it's become a significant issue in nearly 30-40 cities across the country, we still find an addressing legislative mechanism only for the NCR. We're forgetting about the fact that there's an issue across the country, and
that's
we can't
true,
wait
though.
Too long.
In fact, Glory, while India's PM2.5 count has dropped, we really shouldn't be celebrating that, because it's obviously a major concern, since this PM2.5 count is still, what, 10 times above the World Health Organization limits for what is considered safe?
Yes. So the World Health Organization considers 5 micrograms per cubic meter safe, and India literally has over 10 times that amount on average, well over 50. And within Delhi, we're looking at the average being about 90 micrograms per cubic meter. And within New Delhi in particular, when we isolate New Delhi out of Delhi, that's well over 80 micrograms per cubic meter.
Gloria, how extensive is the survey of air pollution you've done in India, just so that I understand it better? How have you collected this data?
We collect this data. This is what's called an empirical process. So we literally have ground level sensors. You've seen probably other reports that focus on modeled data or satellite data. So our sensors, we have hundreds of sensors that we collect data from within the country of India. And these are ground level sensors. So they're at the level that folks are actually walking around and breathing air pollution.
Polash Mukherjee, let me come to you next. you know, what we were talking about earlier with Gopal, you know, on actual deaths, and we were referring to this with Gloria as well. In fact, there are several studies now which have been done on killer air. In fact, IQ Air in 2021 did a report with Greenpeace, 54,000 premature deaths in Delhi 2020 because of air pollution. That's their analysis. Lancet says 1.6 million premature deaths due to air pollution in 2019, with India topping in deaths because of air pollution globally, China second. So there is a corroboration now being statistically available, and there are about five or six studies between air pollution, and that really should be changing the way we look at this, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Vishnu. I mean, the data is out there, and more we are seeing that the data is now localized. It's generated by local research groups that are generated. Lancet, for example, uses an extensive network of ICMR-based researchers to come up with this data. I think the question really is that reports like the one by my co-panelist, Glory, highlight that this is a problem that is extensive across India. It is not a problem. I mean, my co-panelist Gopal also said that it's not something that's localized for Delhi, NCR. Neither is it just the Indo-Gangetic Plain, but it's India's own National Clean Air Program identifies 133 cities that don't meet India's own air quality standards. And let's put aside the fact that India's own standards are much more relaxed compared to the WHO standards. So it really is a matter of governance, and is a matter of whether the emergency status that such a epidemic can be attributed to is being accorded to it. I think cities and states need to work on it on a war footing. And while there have been progress that has been made in the last couple of years, is it enough? I don't think so.
Glory, what is the primary cause of air pollution in India according to the data that you've collected? And, you know, what is the economic cost of air pollution? Do you have numbers for India?
Sure. Yeah, so there are three main primary reasons for air pollution within India. First and foremost is the dependence on coal-burning plants to produce energy. Also, transportation is accounting for 20 to 30% of air pollution, as well as crop burning. So these are really areas that affect the overall infrastructure. And so what really needs to be done is a change in the infrastructure in terms of looking more towards clean emission ways in order to produce energy, as well as looking at the transportation side, how to really optimize that with low to no emissions, as well as crop burning. There are so many other things that can be done, especially in terms of composting. And really on the regulation side, there's a lot that needs to be done. But the cost of air pollution is tremendous. Greenpeace did a very profound study on the cost of air pollution, and not only does it take millions of lives unnecessarily every year, but it's also negatively affecting our overall global economy. There are folks that cannot go to work. There are kids that cannot go to school. The overall health impact is tremendous. And in terms of the economic impact of the health impact, it makes a lot of sense to invest in infrastructure that reduces air pollution and eliminates air pollution, because it just makes financial sense.
You know, Gopal, let me just address the elephant in the room. You know, in our system of governance, in a country which is democratic, unlike, let's say, a China, where you can actually fix a crisis like we've seen in Beijing through very, very strict measures, we don't actually have a system, legal or otherwise, that can enforce something like that. And therefore, are people like you and me sort of destined to live the rest of our lives through this air pollution?
Well, Vishnu, I would like to say that we did, in fact, have some very strong measures when Delhi specifically had terrible air pollution in the late 90s. I think both of us are great enough to recall that phase when we had grim fog throughout
and the winter season.
Yes, but the Supreme Court did three important things. And when everybody says, why are we going to court? Shouldn't we have legislative and executive processes which address it? The fact is legislative and executive processes failed for 35 years ever since New Delhi was notified under the AIR Act as a sensitive area. And a petition was filed in 1985 about air pollution in Delhi. Since then, there has been no legislative and executive step that has been taken which has had any effect. What the Supreme Court did in a two-year period was to convert all diesel vehicles into CNG, despite severe protests, to push more than 200 polluting industries outside the NCR, about 100 kilometers away, and to do the same with brick kilns. Now, those are tough actions and almost hinging on the borders of democracy, because that's something China can do easily. But the Supreme Court did it, and we had a good 10-year period from 2000 to 2010 when the air was much cleaner. If we had such kind of stiff, strong efforts, it would make a big difference. Unfortunately, the Delhi NCR has embraced what I think is a ludicrous the Graded Response Action Plan, the GRAP, conceived by the erstwhile body which was pretty much attempting to address pollution and which is continued now by the new entity. And we are in the state of emergency for the last 7 years. There's no question of a graded response. You don't nudge a person into the ICU hour by hour if he has to be in the ICU a week ago. But that's the way we've been addressing it. But there's a second issue I wanted to just bring to your notice, Vishnu. As Glory was saying, their report is primarily dealing with PM 2.5, which is one of the essential components of air quality. But I think we need to understand that there are several other components apart from PM 2.5. PM 2.5 is the most serious because it's the tiniest. It embeds itself in your lungs and will never leave your body. And that's what we're seeing in the lungs of infants in Delhi. They're virtually gray when they should be pink. But there's also nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, ozone, ammonia, and lead. All eight components go together to form AQI, which is why, while in some areas, crop burning may be an issue, like in the north, a larger part of the pollution is because of that. That's not the case in Bombay. You land in Bombay and you can see the amount of construction happening there. So construction dust is a big issue. We need something done comprehensively and urgently by identifying the local sources of those pollution and putting them down, but not in a graded fashion, in an urgent overnight fashion.
Polash, if we look at the contribution of the auto sector to air pollution in India, India is not quite there as yet, despite our ambition at transiting or at moving over to a large number, a large percentage of electric vehicles. That'll take at least another 10 years. Presently, on the roads of the National Capital Region, we're adding about 1,000 new cars a day. Those numbers are ludicrous. A, we don't have the infrastructure. That's a separate issue. But the volume of air pollution, even when it comes to cars which are Bharat Stage 6, is very, very high. So which government would then turn around in India and say, let's stop the sale of cars, let's become a Singapore overnight, and we will fix our public transportation system to make it accessible properly for everyone. Now, we've been talking about this for a decade. It's not been done because in India, it just seems it cannot be done. Your thoughts?
I think you kind of addressed it in the sense that air pollution is an outcome. To resolve air pollution, you need to work on all the different processes that kind of contribute to air pollution. It's not just clean transport or clean energy or clean industry, but it is a composite of all these processes. And that's where strong governance comes in very strongly. And here we are talking about health. And I just wanted to point this out, that health is a very key evaluative lens that ought to be used in the decision-making process for air quality management very strongly. And this is something that's not happening right now. If you look at the NCAP, the National Clean Air Program, that is the flagship program for India's air pollution management, it does not mention the words health at all. There is no correlation from health, from the health management perspective. It's very focused on reduction of PM 2.5 levels in particular. So you therefore need to bring in at the governance stage an evaluative framework which weighs in the health benefits of each intervention. What's happening right now is that across India, 133 cities are debating what actions must they take in order to effectively counter air quality. And unless there is a strong monitoring and evaluation framework, data-driven policymaking, that is the problem. The second, of course, is that our urban local bodies are overworked. I mean, Gopal kind of mentioned this, that there has been a failure of the executive and the legislature to work on this comprehensively. And that's partly attributable to the overburdening of the executive decision makers. There are no specialized personnel that would look at environmental health as a framework like this. There are other disasters that have a very close linkage to air quality, like, for instance, extreme heat at the moment. So there needs to be an overhaul in the governance structure, especially in urban local bodies. India is going to urbanize very quickly in the next 20 years. And unless we make changes there, we know which route we're headed down.
Glory, I live in Delhi, and my panelists also do. It's been what, the most polluted capital in the world in the past. Not so this time, though the overall numbers are still very poor, as we've been saying. That said, do you believe that there's been some sort of relative improvement in the national capital region in these numbers? Our neighboring towns, Gurugram, Noida, Ghaziabad, Faridabad, apparently there's been a decline in their pollution levels?
There actually technically hasn't been.
Oh, really? I see.
When we isolated a New Delhi and we looked at the neighboring towns, New Delhi was actually slightly cleaner than the rest of Delhi. So also the neighboring towns, there really wasn't a tremendous amount in terms of improvement. There is, basically, these towns are so far away from the WHO standards that there really does need to be a serious intervention. And we're relying on individuals is not going to make that impact that really needs to be made. This actually needs to be an infrastructure change, a change in regulations that will make the difference. And I can say that it can be done because we've seen it being done in other countries. And I know that that India is not a country that regulates in the same manner that China did or China does. But it is possible to collectively move toward cleaner energy and towards cleaner policies that make an overall big impact, because we've just seen a double-digit improvement on China's side, and it is possible when people get behind it, when there are some regulations or change, it is possible to turn that wave and to make an impact in a positive way.
Well, let's hope that does happen. And I've been saying something for the last couple of years, and I regret that I need to say this again. If we were to take a recording of this program and play it out 2 years later, nobody would know the difference. We just look maybe a bit younger now then, but no one would know the difference in terms of the content. None of us. Because the more things change, it's the air pollution that remains the same, and millions continue to suffer. Does anybody really care? But thank you very much for sharing that reality check. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us this evening.